Welcome everyone to episode 6 of this season 2 of Doctor Who podcast with a K, whatever it's called. I'm James McLean. With me this week I have Magnus, who you may remember from episode 1. Oh, there you go. Someone. Doesn't she sound a delight? She does sound a delight. That being said, I'll just read to you what she said when I asked her to do this podcast. Why make me do things? Followed by, I hate things. And don't use that against me. And finally, fine. So you can see she's very much geared. They're very much geared to do this. Okay, right. So this is episode 6. I've made Magnus watch this today. You've not watched all of this series, have you, so far?
I haven't watched any since the last one that I saw, which was the first one.
I don't think you've lost anything by... I mean, you tell me. I mean, so this is the first one. This is episode 6, so of 8, so we've got 2 more to go. I did actually think this is genuinely a really good one to have you on, just because it is quite gay.
Come on.
Is that...
And for the record, I'm not that flavor of gay.
So, just, yes.
So, you know, Magnus... doesn't really fuck with Eurovision.
Yes, I noticed that, and I won't find the text message, which was very much like Eurovision. You were not overly keen when you found out this episode was around Eurovision.
And I'm not going to lie, I was extremely compelled from the beginning of the episode, so
right.
That's on me, really.
So,
but that doesn't mean that I'm willing to... get into Eurovision, which I'm not.
Absolutely fine. Nor am I. Although I did end up watching the end of it last night, which was
has
wild.
Did someone win? Is it finished now?
Yes, or it's not finished. It's all done.
Who won?
I think it was Austria, top of my head. But yeah, it's wild. I'll talk to you about it later. But for the sake of this, obviously this is far beyond... the most recent one. This is the far future. The Doctor experiencing an interstellar version of the Eurovision Song Contest that happens, assumedly, many years from now. It was written by Juno Dawson, who is the first transgender writer for Doctor Who. Which I think is kind of interesting.
Yes, I know them by reputation. So I recognised the name when it came out.
Cool. So let's just ask you what you thought.
I really liked it. I thought it was a really well done episode. It kept the pace going from the beginning, which I feel sometimes Doctor Who doesn't quite manage. Sometimes it takes a bit too long to set up the premise, and then you have the titles, and then there's like a bit more waiting around. But I felt like this was quite punchy, so, and the story was quite coherent, and I liked it. I thought it was good.
It's been a very good series that you have not been watching.
The second one put me off because I didn't care about the idea of an evil cartoon character.
It was the weakest, I think, so far of the 6.
Yeah, so then I just wasn't in the vibe, and also I don't sit down to watch things. I was very intrigued by the dead space station.
Yeah,
space horror-esque one. I love horror in space, but I don't know. I must have been busy or absent or doing something incredibly important when it aired.
Absolutely. I am sure you were doing something incredibly important. Raising that frog army would certainly surpass the need to watch the well. But now I assume the frog army has been raised and is active.
It's still in tadpole phase.
Oh. Well, once it's done, it's well worth checking out the well. But yeah, so I mean, I really like this one as well. I went in with no interest when I found out it was about the Eurovision, and I was like, I don't really care, and I'm not really sure that a satire on Eurovision is something which particularly interests me. But you're right, it just was good all the way through.
That's because it wasn't a satire of Eurovision. It just was Eurovision and also Doctor Who. It wasn't a satire. That's what Eurovision is.
Well, I mean, there was, I think there's probably a few subtexts there. I mean, you've got this setup of this people, this displaced people who are kind of not recognised by the community. And the sort of, that there are sort of parallels playing out there in terms of, you know, potential. I suppose you could see it from various different spaces. But yeah, I think that is something which Eurovision in itself, regardless of what a year it is about. It's almost about trying to ignore political tensions and just have Indeed. Fun. But you can't, and it doesn't, because its voting is inherently political. So yeah, I think there's some interesting subtext there. But yes, you're right. It was a surprise. I mean, I really liked, and I have all through the series, but I particularly liked, I thought, Nshuti's performance. Not just his performance, but the writing for him gave him something to have fun with.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed. And I really enjoyed the glitter gun. Glitter gun is from Revenge of the Cybermen in 1974, and it's not that. Yes, it was the confetti cannon. I really enjoyed the confetti cannon. I thought that was a lot of fun.
As he said, very camp.
Very camp, but just fun. Yeah, I think it's one of the good things about the format is that you can. As you said, you can do the space horror of the well, and then you can the next week do the confetti cannon, and it all sort of fits together.
Mm, yes.
Did the ending of this mean anything to you? Did you watch it after the credits? Or mid-credits?
Yes, I did. You've said before about the Rani and how... the audience always thinks it's the Rani, and it's never the Rani, and it's not going to be the Rani this time. So how do you feel?
I feel a little let down, to be honest. I was looking forward to it not being the Rani just to frustrate the audience once more. The guest we had last week, Gareth Cavanna, was suggesting it would be based on a story called The Mind Robber, which was from the 60s. And I think he thought because that was going to be where it's from, the land of fiction, that was going to be the big bad in this. But no, it looks like we have the Rani finally. So all
it's
those...
Double bluff.
Yeah, double bluff. I mean, I remember I can't remember when that Sarah Jane Adventures show started. Must have been like 2000. Oh, God, I can't remember 2008. It was a long time ago. But I remember with that, there was a character in there called Rani, and people even there were sort of saying she'll be revealed to be the Rani. You know, this need for the Rani has been going around for well over a decade, and they finally got it. And through this bioregeneration as well. So we seem to have two, which is interesting. So you don't know anything about the Rani then, apart from what I've said, that the fans always wanted to be the Rani.
No, I don't really. Well, I mean, they're a Time Lord, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Evil Time Lord.
They were a Time Lord played by Kate O'Mara, who was a famous 70s/80s actress of the time. And yes, it was a Time Lord which was absolutely fascinated with doing experimentations. And initially, it was very much less an evil, but just entirely ambivalent to anything but their experiments sort of character.
Yeah.
So there was no sort of massive evil agenda like you have with the Master, but it was more of a sense that they... just want to be left alone to do their horrific, immoral experiments, and that was it. But that sort of shifted when she reappeared again for her second appearance. And she had some weird, I can't remember, convoluted thing with Einstein and various other minds feeding a big brain and all that sort of stuff. Mm. So I don't know where they're going to take her for this return. She certainly in the past seemed more like the version we saw at the end rather than the previous Mrs. Flood version, which didn't seem very Rani-like. But yeah, I mean, do you feel, as someone who doesn't have all that history, what's it like when you get that sort of reveal? Does it mean anything? Do you feel like fascinated by it, or do you feel almost like this is something that other people know about and you should know about and you feel left out of it? How does it land?
Well, I was pleased that they finally sort of revealed whatever Mrs. Flood is up to. So I was getting a little bit frustrated with the, who's this spooky old woman who's kind of doing stuff, but also she's very peripheral to the stories, like the actual episodes. So I was glad that that's finally over with.
And yeah, because she's been in each herself. One of the series.
Yeah. The Rani definite article seems very cool, very different to Mrs. Flood. But it seems like they are two very different personalities, even if they are one person. Very, a bit unlike the Doctor, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose the Doctors can have slightly different personalities. I suppose they're core.
I know, but it seems like one is subservient to the other.
Yeah, there is a bit of that. I suppose there is a bit of that, which they've never really done with the Doctors. I suppose that's because you've got main character energy for all of them, and you don't want any of them to, one of them to, for the audience, one doesn't want to be subservient to the other because people have their own affiliations. But yes, that is different, and we'll see how that plays out. It's curious. So we've got two episodes left to go. So this was, as you say, apart from giving a bit of a spoiler, this was very much set as a standalone in a lot of ways. The other thing which I suppose worth mentioning is these flashbacks, or not these flashbacks, these flashes that he's having in his head. Did that mean anything to you?
The granddaughter. Not hugely, but it was sort of reminding me of the previous series finale. With the Egyptian god on the TARDIS and
yes,
everything yes. being it's the end of the world, and he was looking for his granddaughter maybe, or maybe
yes,
he wasn't. And all
yes,
of this
was. Yeah, forgot about
I was
that.
Like, yes, I remember there being a lot of lore happening in that episode which I didn't retain any of, but I wondered if it was being if that was supposed to remind the audience of stuff.
I think I remember once, I don't know if it was for the podcast or not, I tried to subject you to the first episode. I think it was for this podcast, the first episode of the whole show. Didn't we do that?
I don't know
the
whether
black
we...
black and white one?
We did watch it, but I don't know whether we recorded it. Maybe we did.
No, but that was with the same actress. So it's the
same actress as who's in...
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they brought same actress back. So there's
How are we supposed? How am I supposed to know that?
Well, this is what is interesting, isn't it? It's like where this sort of stuff lands. If it's not really, I suppose it is for you because you're a watcher of the story and the story is unfolding with this character. But its reveal means so much less for most people watching the show than a small amount of people who will make that connection.
So what does it mean?
Well, we don't know, but in terms of the production, she is the oldest character left in the show, living main principal character. William Russell, who played Ian, passed away last year. Barbara Wright, who was the other companion, passed away way before that, sort of slightly after, early 80s. And William Hartnell passed away sort of mid-1970s. So she's the sort of last one of that original group. So from a, I suppose from a fan point of view, it's a kind of exciting space to be. And if this does end up being the final season forever or for now, it's kind of a nice bookend.
Yeah, I can see that. I enjoyed the episodes that we watched that were in black and white. Very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, if you ever interested, they've now, as I said, colorized two. I think they're colorizing another one as well this year. So there's now two episodes on iPlayer, a third one which will probably pop on, and they've been edited down so they're a little less, well, I mean, they were meant to be aired in 20 minutes per week, and so they've been edited into sort of like more of a sort of film length, and they're fairly good, I think, how they've tightened them up and they play into the legacy. How do you feel when you're watching Doctor Who again as a sort of pseudo outsider to it? How do you feel watching it compared to the rest of the stuff you're watching at the moment? Do you feel, because it's a conversation I've had with a few people over the last few weeks, like its longevity, where it goes from now, where does it sit outside of that, you know, I don't want to say rabid fandom, but certainly that passionate fandom?
I think Doctor Who has a lot of longevity in comparison to other stuff that's being aired. I think just because it's got that long history and it was a flagship show for the BBC, so it's emblematic of a lot of TV cultures and a lot of digital and fandom cultures. So I think it has that kind of staying power. Whereas really big budget blockbustery type shows that we're being sort of geared towards on streaming services can have a huge viewership, and some of them maintain it for a whole season, but that's also very flash in the pan. So like people were very excited about the second season of Severance, and that was dropping each week. But once those episodes have aired, they do kind of get forgotten about for a significant period of time until a new season is about to be dropped. If a new season is dropped. So I think this is a very different type of show where it can maintain, even if it doesn't bring in the same type of audiences or even the same numbers, it's just a different type of media object, I guess. But I think being engaged with in a slightly different way.
Well, Gareth last week was saying that despite Disney spending on Doctor Who and being its distributor, its revenue that it gets from Disney is predominantly spent on advertising. If Disney did walk out, it's not costing the incredible amount of money that the Star Wars stuff is costing Disney. You know, it's a different beast in that sort of sense as well. He also noted, which I thought was interesting, that from what he understands is that it's the areas it's not doing so well is America and the UK, but it's doing elsewhere. It's doing quite well globally for Disney in other regions.
In terms of watching it on TV each week?
In terms of its value to Disney. I'm not quite sure what metric is at play there. But and I'm interested again, you know, why that is. And I wonder if, you know, is this something to do with sort of Western culture and the saturation of sort of very highly Westernized science fiction output? Doctor Who feels, as you say, certainly in its current incarnation, as if it's being far more progressive, and I know some would say woke, than a lot of the other franchises can be. And when they have tried to be, say, with the Acolyte for Star Wars, that's fallen apart for them. Well, it's almost encoded into Doctor Who that it can do that.
I think the diversity and progressiveness is not about, because I don't think that is why UK audiences or American audiences might not be watching it as much as other international audiences. I think it, Doctor Who is a very easily recognisable, accessible piece of UK Western sci-fi that has got a really strong association with the BBC. And as a distributor, like BBC World Service was a very trusted media distributor internationally. So in terms of places that aren't the UK and aren't America, it doesn't surprise me that that association would remain, even if it is being distributed by Disney, and that people might be actively choosing to watch it over the plethora of other things that are available. I think culturally it's an interesting, but also I think it's a really interesting way of accessing Anglophone media and culture. So I think a lot of international audiences watch it for that reason, just as
that would make sense.
You know, I think it's also along the lines of like why BBC period dramas are so popular in places like Japan. So just like as a form of consuming culture rather than anything, rather than just anything else. And yeah, I mean, woke is a nonsense word in this context.
Yeah, anyway. I wasn't trying to say that I think its values are what would make it interesting to international audience. I was just wondering whether its values is in a way doing a lot which a lot of other of its competitors that are coming out of, certainly out of the States, because we don't really do sci-fi, aren't doing. Perhaps, but then that's a big jump, because Strange New Worlds certainly is. And I just wondered whether some of that was making it seem more, giving it more of a unique IP than the others. But I think you're right. I think the sort of Anglophone element that Doctor Who still carries, I think is probably a far better explanation as to why it might be carrying in other territories than.
And I think that in terms of the political and wokeness element of it, I think that because anti-woke, anti-trans sentiment is so strong in the UK and the US at the moment, I think any dip in viewing figures or dip in interest in any show is often attributed to those things, like because the rhetoric around everything is so strong that that's often going to be attributed as the reason why something's not doing so well.
It was interesting, something else Gareth said was how the BBC, when the show shifted and had Peter Capaldi, from some of the sort of internal discourse going on, that there was quite an upset about that because the show had such success in having a very young, marketable, attractive lead figure, and they felt there was a drop off because suddenly you had this crabby, mature Scotsman.
I don't know why they thought that was less hot.
But it does make you wonder how much the leads do sell this. I mean, I still wonder with Capaldi. I think that was obviously a factor. I think Capaldi unfortunately comes in when streaming starts to take hold and suddenly there's a lot more shows
combat
against.
The problem was the first episode was really crap. For me, anyway. And I had a lot riding on it because Peter Capaldi had been taken from Three Musketeers, where he was fantastic.
He was great in that, yes.
And I was quite upset. And I was like, well, Doctor Who better be, you know, amazing, because otherwise I've lost him from Three Musketeers, and that's a travesty. And I remember watching the first episode, and I really liked him as the Doctor, and there were elements I really liked. Just in general, the script and the episode felt like nonsense, and just didn't enjoy it at all.
No.
But I've heard good stuff about those seasons, but I just never went back to it because I'm easily off-put and I don't want to ever do any work in terms of watching stuff. It's either, you know, I just didn't.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, from knowing you, that there's that sort of cat-like flex that if it's on and you're in front of the television and you are calmed, then you will watch. And if you enjoy something, you'll watch it all at that moment. If it then fragments and goes elsewhere and you're somewhere else when it comes back, you're not going to leap and pounce on watching the rest of it, even if you would like to watch it. But so
I do think the young attractive lead bit is really important for Doctor Who, only because the character is so, you know, charismatic and strange and otherworldly and powerful and also a little bit angry, that so long as the actor is carrying it off, then the young hot aspect doesn't really matter as much. Because I thought Matt Smith was, I was unimpressed when he was cast, so I didn't really watch much of any of his seasons. But I've seen some of his episodes, and he made a really good Doctor. But I think emphasizing the fact that Peter Capaldi didn't represent young and hot for an audience probably wasn't the main reason that there was a drop-off.
No, I probably agree with you on that. And also, at the moment, I mean, Shooty is just
a delight.
He looks great. He's got what I think Capaldi didn't have, as you say, in terms of writing. For me, Capaldi, he did three series, and in each series, he was slightly different. Didn't know where to sort of land his character. And I think they found him in the last series, but it was very mixed. But with Shooty, it just feels such a natural performance. I mean, when he's there and he's calling people babes, and it doesn't feel like it's written. It doesn't feel, or it just flows. Everything about that character and him just feels so naturally in sync.
Yeah.
Even when he's angry, I don't know. I just really like his characterization on this show, because it's the first time in a long time, and I said this last week, where I kind of feel the Doctor feels written for the actor rather than the actor sort of parroting a sort of Tom Baker, David Tennant-esque crazy wackiness. And he's sort of wacky and he's very much in his own skin. And that's just...
Yes. He's what the kids call... He's got Riz.
I knew you were going to go with the Riz. He has Riz, yeah. And I love it. I just love watching his performance in that sense. Very different to previous Doctors, where I've loved to watch them for their sort of outlandish eccentricities. But with him, it feels like any eccentricities are just firmly built in. They're not pushing against conventions or, dare I say, it's like neurotypical behavior. As I think, to me, Doctors before that were always about that. Someone who's slightly out of sync with the conversation, someone who's slightly out of sync with what's the right way to do things or the way you expect to do. While with Shooties, you feel is a very much more sort of not necessarily harmonized to everyone else, but it doesn't feel like there's an artificialness going on there. Or I don't want to say, I don't know. There's just something different there. Something far more fluid about that. That character, which I've just enjoyed, especially in this last episode.
Yeah.
So, yes. The only thing, the one bit I found a little frustrating was they set up that these people aren't dead, which I don't want to sound awful, mildly disappointed about that. I think just because the sheer visuals and the horror of suddenly all these people just being taken out of this story was so impactful to know that they were not dead, probably cryogenically frozen because cold does that to people. And then at the end, there 10,000 people or 100,000 people, I think they said, were somehow initially one by one and then in pods of like eight were brought back. It all felt very, it felt quite a clunky way to finalize a situation which almost felt like you didn't need to finalize, which I kind of understand. I know why they did. But it took me out a bit for a moment because I was thinking this would take months. This is like a month's of job and of pulling people into this. Am I just being too
picky
there?
You know what it is, James? It's the power of gay audacity. Which is that being woefully underprepared or underqualified for something, but being gay and having the audacity to think you can do it and then being able to do it successfully, masterfully, in fact. Because he finds the two watches, participants, people, who, attendees, the two attendees whose spot the Doctor and Belinda take are a gay couple, and one of them's an expert in holograms and the other one, you know, is a medic. So it's through the power of gay audacity that they managed to save everyone, and I think that's brilliant, especially for a, you know, a campy Eurovision episode. And yeah, I think the visual of all those people, you know, essentially being killed at the beginning was very powerful and compelling. It didn't really take me out of it that they were managed to be revived, because that's the kind of show that Doctor Who is. Like, they manage to save the day usually, so that's good, and I like that. Also, I think because of the parallels with real life Eurovision and the way that we see real life political tensions play out in that arena, if you actually had killed the entire audience because of two terrorists, for want of a better word, whose planet has been destroyed by, they're holding the contest culpable, really, and all the viewers culpable. Mm. I think if you'd let all those people die, it's a lot more pointed in terms of the culpability of all viewers, so the viewer of Doctor Who as well. So I think that would have been quite a jarring note to have.
I think I'd have just found a way to have done it quicker. I know that they were looking
at Rylan Booth. Did you do it quickly, James? What are you talking about?
Well, I don't know. I just feel like a sort of a couple of lines and then get that out of the way, rather than sort of the one by one and then a few in these small little pocket spaces. I don't know. But I agree with you. I think tonally it would have felt weird at the end if they had done as you said, or as I'd said, and they'd all died. I'd like to return just very briefly, because I enjoy it so much, the gay audacity. Do you think that is something which, regardless of the Doctor, is that something which is embedded or encoded into the Doctor to some degree, or do you feel it's very much, I mean, obviously it's very much part of Nshuti's approach, but just generally speaking?
He's definitely audacious. I think more, I don't know, it's hard to say. He's such an OP character, isn't he, in all incarnations. I think perhaps Jodie Whittaker's Doctor probably had more gay audacity, but then that might be because when she's being read as a female character in television, there is a different... She's just interpreted in a different way, or the Doctor is interpreted in a different way.
Yeah, I suppose I'm also thinking, going back to the dare I call it the 20th century Doctor Who, because he's a very much, he's not a gay character, but he doesn't speak but to he's the sort not of heteronormative.
He's not a straight character.
That's what I mean,
possibly the first Doctor, possibly, you could argue, is a straight character, kind of more in line with Peter Capaldi, just based on being an older, white, grumpy man. But the others, it's not so much about gayness, but about, you know, when we talk about the overlap between neurodivergence and being neurotypical or being cisgendered or being trans, or being straight and being gay, it's not about being a thing. It's about representing all of those forces and powers or modes of being that are just slightly out of sync with what the mainstream is. So it's just about being... It's almost countercultural in a way.
Yeah.
Or just an outsiderness. The Doctor is, you know, very powerful in terms of his outsiderness.
Yeah. And I always used to think for years, and I sort of shifted it, my goalposts a little more recently for reasons, obvious reasons, well, obvious to us anyway, that I always imagined a person growing up in the 70s, a gay man specifically in the 70s, someone like the Doctor would be such a powerful role model, not because of any sort of queer reading per se. Well, no, maybe because of a queer reading, not so much gay, but just that sort of, as you say, that non-straight, and not just in terms of not being interested in women, as very much is part of most principal hero male characters on television, certainly in the 70s and 80s, but also in the way that they can wear what they want and they can act how they want. And as I say, more recently, as you've just said, opening that up to sort of like neurodivergence and thinking of people who either were or didn't realize sort of things like autism and ADHD, which is sort of very much composites in there too. I just think that sort of lineage of audaciousness, or as you say, non-straight audaciousness, is really interesting. And I suppose very much suited for a story around Eurovision Song Contest. If you were to give it a number out of 10, I know you are very much against this, as I normally would be, but given I've now got to play the... dare I say the straight role here and throw to you, what sort of rating would you give this as a sense of enjoyment?
I would give it 4 spaceships out of 5 poppies.
Oh, interesting. On the surface, that sounds a good rating. I mean, obviously, dependent on the values of the spaceships to poppies, hard to say, but I get the impression from all of this that you enjoyed it, which is good.
Do you find
things like having Ryland in this and Graham Norton popping up, do you enjoy that? Is that something, these sort of weird sort of guest star drops?
I think who is Ryland? I've seen him. I don't know what he is or what he does or why he is on TV, but he also represents exactly the type of character that he played, which was basically himself. It wouldn't surprise me if he hosted Eurovision in however many years' time. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, kind of a... He's a non-entity. An empty vessel, an empty signifier, if you will. he perfectly encapsulates a host who is cryogenically frozen between each year of the Space Eurovision Song Contest. It makes sense, and it was fine. And the character was perfect. I don't care that it was Rylan, but it makes sense that it was. I enjoyed the Graham Norton hologram, but again, just because of the relationship to the Eurovision Song Contest. It's more, he was a cultural touchstone, so it just gave the episode more flavour.
He was saying recently how back when it came on television in 2005, Doctor Who, he, at the time, quite famously, had a role in the first episode where they seemed to have, there was some sort of weird mix mistake where in the first scene when the Doctor's down in the basement, there's a voiceover for, I think it's his promotion for, might be in the Eurovision then, he was doing some sort of promotion thing which accidentally got transmitted at the same time as Doctor Who was transmitting. And some people thought it was like Billy Piper Rose's Walkman playing Graham Norton, when in fact it was just some sort of weird cross-transmission. And so he actually appears in that first episode, Rose, without actually being in that first episode. The Rylan thing has began to make me think a little bit, and just like, what's the character Rylan's contract here? Because by this, it almost suggests that he is only unfrozen for these events.
It does suggest that, yes, which would be so insane.
So he literally exists in Eurovision. There's nothing outside of that. They wake him up, he looks like he's dressed for it, and then he does it, and then he goes back to sleep. Maybe there's a small party after. Is that, it doesn't, there's not even a suggestion really that he's paid for it. It almost suggests that he's almost a product of it.
Perhaps he represents the corporation.
Well, this
maybe
is it.
He just is. Is he even human? He could just be some kind of android VI thing.
But why would you need to be
cryogenically frozen? Possibly, I don't know, aesthetic purposes, maybe. Or maybe he's in hell.
Well, this is it. Is
maybe
there a darker story
this is
there?
Hell.
I mean, this is the whole point. This is this corporation.
It's a dark story.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe even think about it.
Yeah. It's a pretty dark story.
I also thought that the Hellions were well done, because often, especially Kid, I think often that character isn't sympathetic in the way that the script tries to make them, or isn't compelling. And I thought he was, and I thought, I thought that was well done. Because I think that can be difficult. They can be very cartoony sometimes.
What did you think to the message that they had? Because that was a difficult thing, because as you say, to quote you for a better term, they are terrorists, and yet their plight is meaningful and there is empathy there, and yet what obviously they're doing is terrifying. Do you feel the outcome of this balanced out that very difficult thing to balance?
Well, I think because you are able, they bring back the audience, don't they? And so the audience is in debt, so there's technically no consequences. And I guess the viewers at home are only going to be aware of what happened after the fact.
But I'm surprised the Doctor doesn't make any, there's never any sort of, that I recall anyway, commentary from the Doctor in terms of kind of the world
justice.
These two, yes, the question of justice here.
I think that the Doctor is either becoming or just is demonstrating, you know, his self-centeredness. He's very self-focused. He can be very myopic in terms of the justice he dispenses. And in this episode, it seems like there are types of justice that he can dispense, or he basically says that, I lost my temper because they triggered me. The idea of 3 trillion people dying all at once really triggered me, which is valid, because to be emotionally triggered or for a trauma to be triggered, that's how it happens. When someone says something or you experience something and it triggers an emotional, physical, mental, psychological, intense response that is not rational. It just happens. So it makes so it's logical what he said, but at the same time, that's not an excuse. And I think Belinda's intervention and her reminding him at the end what you did or what you said scared me and I didn't like it. And he says he scared himself. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But I think there's definitely an arc of, even though this season is very campy and this Doctor is sort of campier and brighter and effervescent, there's a lot of darkness to it, but not just that, not just darkness, but I don't know whether he's being very responsible. Whereas I feel like in previous incarnations, in previous seasons, the Doctor has a lot of guilt and carries a lot of that stuff around with him, like the weighing up of justice and his role in the universe and things he's done, things he hasn't been able to prevent, the things that he should do, or like, and this Doctor doesn't seem to be encumbered by any of that, where maybe he should. And maybe that guilt was preventing him from being, I don't know, becoming worse almost. Like, well, I do get the sense that this Doctor is a bit unfettered.
I thought it was interesting how they played that out, because essentially, if we take away the science fiction of it, he just starts laying into a guy who's on the floor and he's essentially kicking him.
He's torturing him.
And it was interesting they used the hologram, which seemed to be a way to almost disassociate the act from what he's doing. Do you see? I mean, if they'd actually had him going over there and just electrocuting him with his hands over and over and over again.
Well, I did kind of just see it as him electrocuting him.
Yeah.
That's how I interpreted it.
But by doing the hologram, it does distance him a little bit than if you could imagine if he was actually doing that himself. I thought that was kind of an interesting, it felt a bit convoluted in the way they set it up, but I think they set it up like that because, as you say, they're having him essentially assault someone in a way that doesn't feel too much like he's assaulting them. It's the sci-fi just pulls him away a little bit from what he's, you know, effectively smacking someone with a pipe over and over again, or might as well be. That was a curious scene, and I thought it was good. I thought the way they set up Kid, and I thought it was quite nuanced in the way they made Kid quite unlikable, and yet they made very clear that the driving force behind him was something very, very hideous indeed. You know, to have your whole planet, imagine your own planet or even your own country just wiped out by a corporation just wants
indeed,
a honey
indeed,
flavor.
Doctor, indeed. Imagine the trauma or the consequences of, you know, such an act, what that might drive a person to do. Perhaps, you know,
I see where you're going.
Killing spree, maybe. It felt very, it was really well done, but it does give me questions about the direction of the Doctor or how the Doctor actually sees himself in this incarnation, because he says that you've put ice in my heart and that's always going to be there. And I was like, really?
Yeah,
you've got space for a few minutes and saved yourself the confetti cannon. And you think that, I don't know, it felt very self-justifying.
Yeah. And also there's that line that Belinda has later, which is softened from what she says after, where she sort of says, you know, you're an amazing person. And she does temper that, I think, as I recall, with sort of saying, but, you know, I worry about, you scared me. It just felt very odd to, when she first said, "You're an amazing person." I was like, "Ooh, I don't know if I feel that's right." And as you say, it's softened by the, "But you scared me." But it still felt an odd time to say that after you'd watched someone, as I say, essentially brutalize someone, regardless of whether you felt they deserved it or not. The act that he perpetuated was an uncomfortable thing to see.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think Eurovision itself often brings up for me uncomfortable feelings around viewership and complicity in terms of things like genocide in our real world politics. And I thought it was interesting to have that as part of the episode, really. But then that doesn't get resolved. And the Doctor himself is a survivor of, you know, a mass traumatic event. And this person who's literally called Kid, and the fact that he's called Kid is a commentary on the fact that his mother was murdered before anyone could find out what his actual name was.
Yeah.
And the fact that that, and the fact that that is a real thing that is happening now, that many of us are, have been forced to become spectators to, is troubling, therefore, for the Doctor not to recognise that, because he's supposed to be a champion of, you know, justice. But it's fine, because they're getting back in their TARDIS and they're going to go save Earth, and that's good. It's too late for this planet anyway. The corporation, which corporation? Where's this corporation?
Yeah. Yeah, just kind of accepted. And yes, the Eurovision, it doesn't feel like, the also Interstellar Song Contest doesn't feel like there's any ramifications that go up, which is unusual for the show, to be honest, that that's not really thought about. I just wonder whether there was just so much going on, it was just not something left on the table. But yes, this corporation ruins a planet for honey flavouring and then carries on doing its thing. Yeah. Yeah, the people, yeah, are still...
Also, what do you mean a corporation bought a planet and the population? Like, the inherent fucked upness of that.
And at the same time, again, I suppose, again, there's this sort of subtext that all this stuff is going around, you know, corporations, politics, and all sorts of stuff. And we have these events to sort of try and forget about that sort of stuff. And I think seeing it through the lens of this episode, it just makes that seem so distasteful. That they're all in there are celebrating these, you know, 3 trillion people celebrating this, and yet you've got a universe where corporations can literally buy planets that they don't own, and you know, such an imperial notion. It's imperial corporate. It's terrifying, and yet we know that they leave, and there'll be the same thing next year or whenever they do their next contest. So, yeah, there's so much going on in this episode, which it's been nice to talk about it because, yeah, it is far darker than I think anyone suspected.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. Cool. So episode 7 next week, are you thinking about watching that? Are you made curious?
I'm curious because of the introduction of the Rani. They seem cool.
Yes. I'm interested to see where they take the character, where it doesn't just feel like it's a step on the master. I think that's going to be the interesting distinction, is how do they make this not feel like it's... Because they did the master and Missy, so they've done the female master.
So what's Missy the master? Just a regenerated... Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
So how do you do this where you do not feel like there's that initial comparison to that is going to be interesting. And I'm sure it's something he's Davis has mulled over and toiled over. So fingers crossed, he'll feel fresh. This whole series has felt fresh. Like you said, Lux felt, and one of our previous guests sort of compared it to what the second David Tennant one, Tooth and Claw, with the werewolves and Queen Victoria, many, many years ago, casting
which
mind
one was
back
Lux
to 2000.
First time?
The light one, the one with the cartoon character.
Right.
The one
okay.
you, not in terms of obviously the story, but in terms of the framework, which felt very traditional Doctor Who. It's like a small space, people trapped in it with a very powerful creature and light being a key factor of it. The way
I
it's
liked
described,
the werewolf one.
There were very similar beats in Lux in a lot of ways. I didn't mind Lux. It just didn't feel like anything new. It felt like, again, a very similar approach.
I just didn't care for it.
The rest has been great. The Well's been good. Last week's one was very good. The last week's one was The Story in the Engine, which is set in Nigeria in a barbershop.
Yes.
That one was very good as well. And Lucky Day, the one that came before that, very interesting in terms of its sort of social,
one?
Yeah, social political commentary, and that is quite interesting.
Oh, really?
And well put together. Surprising, because I watched the first 20 minutes and I was like, I'm not interested in this. And then there was a turn and I was like, oh, okay. That's interesting. So all of them have been feeling fresh, apart from, and even Lux had its moments. So it's been an extremely strong series, which is really great to see that a show which is now, what, 20 years old from its rebirth is still able to produce some interesting material.
I get the sense, perhaps, that if they're working towards this, like, maybe there will be, this will be the last season, or maybe there will be at least a really big pause in whatever Doctor Who does. It kind of seems to have lifted the anxiety around making sure there is another season, that the focus seems to be just on making really good episodes, which I appreciate.
Hello. I have a trawl through Instagram after these episodes, and generally speaking, the comments are very, very positive this last series, more so than the series prior. So I think it seems to be doing what it wanted to do, which I think is a very good space to be. Whether this is the last series for Shooty, we will find out. There has apparently been reshoots for the final rewrite, so maybe we'll see whether there has been a quick exit, which will be a shame, as I say, because I like him. I think he's done a good job. But I would suspect if the show carries on forward, this is probably the way it will go. I think there'll be shorter 10 years. I think those 10 years will be the things which lifts it into the public eye in a very saturated market of quality science fiction television. But we will see. We will see. Okay, I think we will leave it there. I think we've covered pretty much everything in that show. Next week, I believe we've got John Kenneth Muir, who is a writer, American writer, to talk about the seventh episode. And I will see you then.